Well, once again, we are recording the Wheelhouse via Skype, as Jerry, we could not be any further apart, and that pains me to say that, but I am in Midtown New York City, and you're way back in one of the glorious conference rooms of Safeco Field. How are you, man?
Excellent, excellent. I think I could dream of scenarios in which we would be further apart, but we certainly would not be in the continental United States.
Right, right, you are. Well, hey, folks, we're sorry that this is coming at you a little bit later in the week. Normally, as you can tell, through our first seven episodes, we've tried to push these out kind of midweek for you, but because of various travel schedules, both for Jerry and myself, we have had to kind of delay recordings. And Jerry, I know you've been in Arizona. We're going to touch on that a little bit. And among other places, I've been on the Mariners caravan to Eastern Washington, which is still going strong. Tuesday, the guys are going to be in Lacey, Washington. Wednesday, a fine play ball event in Vancouver, Washington. Friday, they'll be in Longview. You can get all the details on all the additional stops on the Mariners Glories caravan at mariners.com/caravan. Quick housekeeping, some news and notes on the podcast. We've heard from the Android users. We hear you loud and clear. And Colin, our fearless leader, has done a fine job of getting you set up with the TuneIn app. So give that a shot to subscribe. Of course, you can always subscribe on iTunes as well. But we are excited, Jerry, to talk about a couple of things. First, I feel like I need to talk to you about my few days on the caravan and getting to spend some time with a couple of your players, namely Taylor Motter. And I don't know, Jerry.
I'm dying to hear. Right.
Yeah.
What? Please fill me in. Fill me in.
I mean, I'm going to start by saying 72 hours with Taylor Motter. That would be enough for, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, remember Road Rules? I mean, this is like, he would be perfect on Road Rules. I mean, he really would. So we're driving over the pass, right? And it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. The snow, the mountains, the trees. And, I mean, as you know, Taylor is a Florida boy. And I think I believe him. Do you believe him when he says that was the first time he's seen snow?
I do believe him because in Arizona, spring training kickoff 2017, day one of spring training, Taylor Motter was seen with a mock turtle covered by a hoodie with the hood up top and wearing his heavy jacket for the first morning in the spring in Arizona. So I am buying it, yes.
Well, when we were driving over the pass, and again, scenic picture, I mean, straight out of a postcard, right? He said aloud to the whole bus, "How did the snow get on the trees?" Which at that point, it was awkward for one of us to fill him in that the snow doesn't come from the ground up. It comes from the sky down. So we had a little bit of a lesson there. There was another quote asking whether a moth was a mammal. There was some type of puzzle thing that Taylor was playing on one of our drives. But you know what? He brings the energy, as you know, and he was requested upon multiple times for a hair flip in front of a town forum. So Taylor was a great guy to have in the caravan.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite episodes last spring when we were first getting acclimated to the Taylor Motter experience was in spring training when Scott and the guys, so our, you know, Robbie and Nelly, Seager, the entire team had cooked up this gag where Taylor Motter was being asked to cut his hair for charity. And let's just say he was vehemently opposed to the exercise to the point where he was hiding, he was wearing hats, he was pulling hoodies over his head on a routine basis. And as you may or may not know, Aaron, we have a barber's chair at the facility down in spring training, which was teed up and ready to go for Taylor Motter. And up until the day that the barber came in to do the haircut, donating his locks to charity, which people had effectively determined that they would pay for, Taylor had raised or purportedly raised $50,000 for children's charities, only to walk to the chair with a beet red face and, let's just say, being escorted roughly by a handful of teammates before he got there, only to find out that, in fact, it was all a gag. We were not asking him to cut his hair, and he was very relieved to realize that the golden locks would live to see another day.
That's fantastic. Does the organization, Jerry, do the Mariners have a rule on how long a player's hair can be? I mean, a serious question, because obviously a lot of organizations do have some type of guideline.
No, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the Yankees and the Reds became kind of the last or the remnant of the teams that had the real strict dress codes, I think, or presentation codes. One of the things that we really stressed in the spring of 2016 was come as you are, be who you are. And we encouraged personality, be a little bit different. That's okay with us. And coming into spring training last year with the likes of Taylor Motter and Ben Gamel, if you recall Dylan Overton, we had quite a few guys that were roughly stepping on their own hair. And Scott Servais, who you may or may not have known, doesn't have a lock of hair drifting below the collar line, said, "Hey, I know I told him to be who they are, but man, it's going to take some adjustment for me." And he did.
Yeah, I remember Scott had a kind of prophetic line. We were at a sponsor's dinner in Peoria, and I'm almost positive you were there, Jerry. You must have been. When a fan asked him kind of along those lines about dealing with different personalities, and he kind of likened it to parenting, that you either roll with them or they're going to roll without you, was kind of his loose quote. And I think a lot of people in the crowd kind of took note of that. So kind of a neat thing that I think he learned maybe before he became a manager. I think truly he learned it as a parent, but it's neat that those things kind of carry over to the baseball field sometimes.
Oh, they really do. And I think that's so true. And we talk about it in terms of or reference it as today's player. You know, today's player is just like today's just young people in the world today. And we were no different a generation ago and the generation before us. And you learn to adapt to what is current. And I think Scott's had fun with it. He's learned a lot. And, you know, it helped that we all have, you know, kids in that general time zone or range, and we were able to learn lessons through parenting.
Well, boy, I'll tell you what, Jerry, I was just, before I got to New York, I was in Tempe for about 36 hours or so. And I know you're still bronze from Maui. Okay. Like, let's not forget about that. But as a guy that I really don't get dragged down by Seattle weather, even when it rains for like 10 days in a row, I handle it much better than my wife does. But even for a guy who has a pretty upbeat attitude about gray skies, get into the desert for a brief period of time was amazing. I know it was much more refreshing than I ever could have thought. But I know you were down there near the beginning of the week in Peoria. First of all, it must have gotten your blood rushing a little bit just to kind of get to the complex and be around baseball guys and see the fields. And that must have felt good even regardless of the sun.
Oh, it really did. It was also really encouraging to walk past the physical therapy center, you know, the training room, and see just one guy. That was that was a refreshing thing. But yeah, I was down in Peoria. We put together a series of meetings that were being run by Andy McKay, our farm director, and by Lorena Martin, who's now overseeing our high performance department. And we brought together all our PD, all our high performance group, and a variety of front office personnel for what we called a continued education program. So, you know, 3+ days down there with all our coaches, managers, trainers, strength coaches, analysts, etc. And we went through effectively 3 days of discussing best practices, the ways that we're getting better, identifying the progress that we've made, and then identifying our weaknesses and where we can get better. I thought it was tremendous. It was a great way to bring Lorena and a lot of her people up to speed on what we were doing organizationally. And frankly, it was a better way to spend our time than sitting home watching bowl games.
Hey, I know we've talked about Lorena on the podcast before when her hire was made official, but I was really interested to talk to some of the guys about Lorena who have already interacted with her. And on the caravan, Marco Gonzalez was with us. And of course, Marco lives in Seattle, so he's been at Safeco Field just like a 9-to-5 employee all off season. And I said, "Hey, you know, have you had a chance to talk with Lorena?" And his eyes just opened up. He's like, "Man, this lady is for real." He was trying to cite off all the degrees that she has and was very unsuccessful in naming all of them. And he said that, you ready for this, that she asked him for his wife's phone number to call his wife to find out what was in their refrigerator at home. I mean, did you know that that was going to be part of her job?
Checking on Marco's fridge. Yeah. You know, it seems like a doable thing. But no, Lorena has really, from the particularly with our major league staff, Scott, our staff, and our players, has really connected very quickly. And, you know, unfortunately, the baseball offseason runs quickly when you have a lot to do. And she has had a lot to do. So, you know, right now she's acclimating and getting caught up to speed on player development. But from our 40-man roster and our manager and staff and the major league perspective, I couldn't be more comfortable with the position we're in.
Well, it was neat to get his insight a little bit on Lorena. I know that's somebody that we're all eager to get to know a little bit better once we get down to Peoria. But I was curious just to touch a little bit on player development and the Mariners. And I can only imagine, Jerry, that every organization has their own way of looking at player development besides just the very obvious points of it. How has that kind of evolved or changed for you and Scott and Andy during your time together with the Mariners?
I don't know. I don't know that it's really changed. We came in with a series of ideas, some things we really wanted to focus on, and we've generally done most of those things. And when I say those things, we're setting up programs for how we go about executing in a bat, how we go about fundamental team defense, how we go about something as simple as a bullpen in preparation for a game start. We're trying to set up routines and allow our players stability in their careers. We've developed creative programs. I think we are at the forefront in Major League Baseball in how we drive mental skills and through our organization and the importance of being prepared, both emotionally and intellectually. I think we drive information through our system as aggressively or perhaps as well as any team in baseball. And we spend as much time focusing on developing leaders on our field as we do developing players. And I think to that extent, it's gone very well. We've really put a stress on the idea of developing winning baseball matters. And, you know, if you can judge that by winning games, we've done a fair bit of that in 2 years. I think we're fifth in baseball in win percentage. We've been to 9 postseasons in 2 years as a minor league organization and won 3 championships. And we've done it, as I think most would identify, without the most robust prospect system in the game. Some of that self-inflicted and some of it just something we're working through. But I'm really happy with what we've done developmentally and the progress that we continue to make.
You know, a couple of years ago, Jerry, I think it was 2 years ago at this point, you were with us on probably a Sunday Magazine show, and you dropped the PTPA on us. Can you, just for those who weren't familiar with it, can you explain that one more time?
Yeah, the PTPA is it's something that we've been carrying for quite some time. This dates back to, you know, frankly, to give credit where it's due, the initial idea was Clint Hurdles, who now the manager of the Pirates. And, you know, Clint and Scott and I all worked together in Colorado for a period of time. And then Scott and Clint worked together while Clint was the hitting coach for the Texas Rangers and Scott was the farm director. And when obviously Scott and I have now spent the last 6 or 7 years again together, and we adopted the PTPA as a reference. It's a productive team plate appearance. So effectively, it's measuring offensive contribution without it being all about the result or the damage, you know, the ISO or the slug or the on base, things that we would track normally in a public sphere. We've adopted the PTPA as a way to teach our young players how to play a more selfless game, how to focus on a team-oriented result, and essentially showing them that based on a situation, there are a lot of different outcomes that we can count as a positive. And if you put your teammate in a good position to make a difference, that's positive. So, you know, we have a criteria, and they include simple things like moving the runner over, not making an out, making a productive out, making a hard out. There are a lot of different things that go into generating a PTPA. And 2 years ago, we set up a program where the organizational leader in PTPAs generates an invitation to Major League Spring Training, regardless of the level you played at prior to that season. And we have a tournament that's almost set up like the, you know, March Madness. We'll start out with all of our players, both pitchers and hitters. You know, for pitchers, we have a different set of criteria, and we don't call it a PTPA. But they're effectively strike zone control tournaments. We pit all of our players against one another in a fun competition. The coaches have the opportunity to pick players and pick their brackets. We do it here in the front office, and ultimately there's a winner, and that winner generates an invitation to Major League Spring Training. And for the first time in most of their careers, they get to come to a big league camp, and they generate a paycheck, which is not something that minor league players do, oddly.
That's fantastic. Now, this is, at the end of the season, or no, this isn't a season-long thing. You're saying that this is set up bracket style? Is that, am I understanding this right? This isn't over the course of the whole minor league season?
No, you know, we track the PTPAs. We keep a display on the wall in minor league clubhouses so that the kids can see where they lie, or our players have the ability to measure themselves against their team or even against themselves. And toward the tail end of the season, somewhere around late July, or, you know, 1st of August, we set up a tournament that runs in weeks. So we'll run a 4 or 5 week tournament where the players are pitted against one another. Each player generally plays themselves into a seed, and, you know, the seeds start playing off against one another, and whoever comes out on top gets an invitation to Major League Spring Training. And as I've joked around just this week, you know, making the phone calls to issue the invitations to Major League camp to those who don't have it in their contracts, I jokingly said to the two winners of the tournament, this will be the first time you ever generated a paycheck in spring training. So congratulations. And that's not a small thing. They'll get paid real money. They'll get to a big league camp. They'll get to play alongside Felix and Robbie and Nelson, which is not an insignificant thing. And hopefully they'll learn a thing or two about the transition that's going to come after they graduate from the minor leagues.
Now, is this clandestine as of right now as to who these players are?
No, it is and it isn't. We're going to make a public announcement later next week. But in the case of our PTPA winners, Jordan Cowan, who played at the A levels for us last year, will be the position player. Unfortunately, he's injured and isn't going to be able to take part, but he won the tournament and deserves to come. So he will be a part of our major league camp. And LJ Newsom, also an A-level player who won the pitcher's version of the tournament, will be in big league camp. And I think both of them were just over the top excited, because it's one thing to know that the carrot's out there for you. It's another thing to realize that you're actually going to go do it. It's a pretty cool thing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, am I remembering correctly, Jerry, that and forgive me if my timeline's off, after that was implemented in the minors, it was then the following year implemented at Safeco Field inside the Mariners clubhouse, or those simultaneous, or not done it together at all?
We've always tracked it for our major league players, but we don't broadcast it in the same way. So, you know, last spring it was first brought to the attention of our major league players that we actually do this. And, you know, but it's a different element. Once you get to the major league level, we're not trying to start from scratch. We're not teaching them, you know, effectively how to make a sauce. We're trying to, we're trying to work on the plating, so to speak, for, you know, using culinary terms. And, at the minor league levels, we're teaching them the basics. And that's why for us, the PTPA, the stress on team play, the understanding how to move a lineup is important. And, you know, at the major league level, they're a little bit more of a finished or polished product. And now we're just working on small detail. And that's the difference between coaching at the two levels. I'll give you a quick one, Aaron. So in 2016, we implemented this PTA program immediately after arriving in Seattle. We did the bracket tournament in August of 2016, and the winner of the August 2016 tournament was being discussed in an off-season trade, which ultimately came to pass that did include Taylor Motter and his hair. And the winner of our tournament in 2016 was a first baseman who had played that year in Clinton by the name of Dalton Kelly. And ultimately, Dalton was traded to the Tampa Rays in an offseason deal. And before we would agree to include Dalton in the trade and push it across the goal line, we had a discussion with the Rays, explained the program to them, and that we were resistant to the idea of not following through on our promise. And as a result, the Rays brought Dalton Kelly to Major League Camp. They thought it was a neat idea, and I believe they've now started to incorporate or implement a similar type of rewards program for their kids.
Now this helps explain how you and the Rays are such best buds, Jerry. I mean, that's incredible that they would do this, that they would not only, I mean, adopting the program is one thing, but they could easily have adopted it and not brought Dalton to camp. But that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it was the right thing to do. And the Rays guys, Eric Neander, Matt Silverman, they're just really good people. And they agreed that this was one of those circumstances where we broadcast this. We made it an in-house program that the kids were excited about. And Dalton went out and won the tournament, and he deserved the reward, and he got it.
Well, since you brought up food a moment ago and we were talking about Arizona, I am curious, since we both spend a decent amount of time in Arizona, you more than me, no doubt about that. Oh, one of our mutual friends, Jack Mossman, who I know works for you in a couple of different capacities, including overseeing all the Mariners team travel, he has told me about a restaurant in the Peoria area that looks terrible. It might have been on Triple D. Cheeto Banditos, does this ring a bell to you?
I have not been to Cheeto Banditos, nor has Jack mentioned it to me. So I'm going to have
to... Wow. All right. You haven't been talking to Jack enough, which I can't imagine is the truth.
Definitely not the truth, but he's not sharing this information.
Do you have a favorite guilty pleasure restaurant in the Peoria area? Because I'm sure a lot of people listening will be coming to spring training and would love to have a restaurant recommendation.
Guilty pleasure would be, there's a, and it's a little bit of a drive from Peoria, but in Scottsdale, down by the Biltmore shopping area, there is a gelato spot by the name of Frost, which is outrageous. It's as good a gelato as you're ever going to have. And as far as the Triple D stops, and because there are a ton of them in Arizona in general, in the valley. But there's a spot in Scottsdale, not too far from Talking Stick, by the name of Andreoli Italian Grocer. And it's both an Italian grocery store and effectively an Italian restaurant. You're not going to walk into what appears to be a five-star layout, but the food is terrific. Everything is handmade and made to order, anything from authentic Italian sandwiches to pasta dishes. It's a great spot.
Oh, very nice. I wrote both of those down. You know, we only have one real go-to ice cream place in Arizona, and that's a place called Churn. And it's really close to one of the Bianco locations, and they do a toasted coconut ice cream, which I always say I'm going to get one scoop. And then I get two scoops, and then I can't drive home. It's really good.
Intoxication really good. By coconut ice cream.
It's a lot of ice cream, man, but it is really good. Churn. It's a good spot. I would recommend it to anybody looking for who has got a sweet tooth coming out to spring training. You know, Jerry, so a press release came out today from the Mariners baseball information side of things, and you know, you look at this press release and you go, man, this sounds like a lot of work for Jerry and his guys. You have come to terms with five arbitration eligible players. And these are all guys that are, I mean, these are major pieces, right? James Paxton, David Phelps, Aronson Ramirez, Nick Vincent, Mike Zunino. Is this something that you kind of assume will get done, but just you need to devote the time? I mean, how much of a relief is it when you can kind of check the boxes on all these guys and getting them all signed and ready to go, and you can really turn the page and move on to the next step?
Oh, it is a huge relief. And as you mentioned, from Nick Vincent to Paxton to Zunino, the huge David Phelps, Erasmo, a really important group for us to check off. And, you know, this was the last stage of effectively making sure that all our in-house players were taken care of, at least those who were arbitration eligible or beyond. And I'd be lying to you if I told you it took a great chunk of my time away. A lot of the heavy lifting in this process is done by our director of baseball ops, Justin Hollander, by our assistant general manager, Jeff Kingston, by our scouting coordinator, Tim Stanton, and many others. Emmanuel Cifuentes, Andrew Herrera, Joel Furman. They all contribute in so many ways to this process. And you know, I won't go through and bore you with how arbitration works, but there's no slam dunk that it's going to get done without having to go to a room. And you know, we were able to negotiate what we thought were reasonable settlements with each of the players, coming to agreement on a salary that I think they're all pleased with, and that allows us to go into spring training with, you know, happy, healthy players who are ready to go contribute.
Well, you joined the list of about 29 other teams that all sent out similar press releases today. Everybody's getting that knocked off the list. And along the lines of other general managers, Jerry, as I'm sure you're aware, there was a really interesting article that came out early in the month in the New York Times. And Jerry, you were the lead story in this thing, which wasn't the first time that you've been in the Times, but this was probably under the most humorous circumstances. The whole article was on how general managers communicate with one another, and they told the story that I was unaware of until I read it, that the D. Gordon deal with the Marlins, Jerry, you completed via text message over airplane Wi-Fi. This is true?
This is true. We were actually en route back from Los Angeles, where we were visiting with Shohei Ohtani, and Michael Hill and I, who had spoken, you know, numerous times via telephone prior to consummating the deal over text on a Wi-Fi. Yeah, it was. We were 25,000-30,000 feet up when D. Gordon joined the Mariners.
Now, have you ever made a deal strictly through text, right? No phone call, no nothing. One GM texts another, and a few texts later, everything's ready to go?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Two such trades. And I think over time, I said this laughingly because Michael Hill, once I landed in Seattle and called him, and we worked through the final detail, and we had to set up, you know, press releases and the like. You know, Mike and I worked together with the Rockies back in the early 2000s. I've known him for a lot of years. And Mike said to me, JD, is that the first deal you've done? Oh, just finished over text? And I said, Mike, come on. When you make as many trades as we've made, you tend to do them in weird places or spaces. But no, in this one, we were able to push it across with D in the air. I think one of my favorites was back in the summer of 2016. We were in the midst of what was then, we thought, a really unfortunate run of injuries to pitchers, and we were scrambling. We didn't have anybody at AAA who was ready to go. The AA staff really didn't have anybody that could step up and go to the big leagues. So we were left looking for someone to step in immediately and start a major league game. And that led me to send a quick text message to Ross Atkins with the Blue Jays. And I asked Ross if he would consider, you know, moving Wade LeBlanc, who was then pitching for the AAA Syracuse team in the Blue Jays chain, or Buffalo, I think it was Syracuse. And Ross sent me back a quick message. Yeah, you know, we'd be willing to do that. You know, what would the considerations be? We worked out the considerations over a text message, and Wade LeBlanc became a Mariner and gave us 50 really solid innings in the middle of a summer that really get lost in translation in a season that was starting to get a little turbulent, and Wade came in and settled things down, which was great for us.
Have I told you my informal idea, but now it's formal since it's on the podcast, of the Wade LeBlanc Award? Have we discussed this?
No, but last year's Wade LeBlanc winner would have been Albers, who was
absolutely.
Yeah, he was like the new Wade LeBlanc.
Yeah, I feel like every year there should be a physical trophy handed out to the most unexpected starting pitcher out of nowhere to save the season for the Mariners. And it all began with Wade LeBlanc. So it's the inspiration for some great filler conversation on Mariners radio broadcast. So we thank you for that, Jerry.
And they don't do it. One more quick note. They don't do it great, I guess, far different from one another. You know, Albers and LeBlanc are not too dissimilar. But in the case of Wade LeBlanc, one of the parts of the agreement that we made with the Blue Jays was that in the event that Wade came over, was able to stabilize, and we did get to the point where the other pitchers were healthy and came off, that if Wade was going to run back through waivers, we would first offer him back to the Blue Jays, which set up the potential of trading Wade LeBlanc for Wade LeBlanc. Which would have been awesome. But we weren't able to quite get there, but it would have been awesome.
Now, does something come to mind when I ask you the strangest place that you have made a trade official?
The strangest place, nothing really comes to mind. You know, heavens knows whether it's negotiating contracts, talking with other teams, so many different conversations, the headset in. It could be pool beachside when you're on vacation. It could be in your office. It could be in generally any room of my house, and I do mean any. There are any number of different places you'll find yourself in, talking on a treadmill. Communication is a funny thing. When the other team is engaged and you feel like you're closing in on something, you're really not inclined to care about where you're sitting when you need to get a deal done.
Well, we look forward to when you break a deal on the Wheelhouse. We will. Although I gotta say, behind the scenes story, and Jerry, you're almost too respectful of the podcast. You always put your cell phone far away from you when we record these, which I mean, it's very nice of you, but I don't ever want you to miss something.
I think we're actually crawling up on maybe the 1 year anniversary, and I wish I could remember the exact player that this happened with. But last year during media week, just prior to spring training, I was sitting on the dais, effectively being questioned by the media as to what we had done in the offseason, and Ryan Divish had asked me the question, you know, does that do it for your roster moves? And I said, I don't know if it quite does it yet, or something along those lines. And by the time we got off the dais, we had just executed another addition, I think, via waiver claim. And he said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, no, the deal that was already done. We just hadn't announced it prior to walking off the stage.
Well, you know, lastly on that New York Times article, Jerry, I know you know Brian Cashman very well, your counterpart for the Yankees. I almost still can't believe it when another general manager said that Brian Cashman had the most expansive collection of gifts. I mean, come on, Cashman? That's the last guy that I would guess would have a gift library that he'd be texting to all you guys. But can you confirm this?
I can confirm that there are many out there that will go fairly deep on the gifts, and I am self-admittedly one of those. And it depends on who you're dealing with. I've got anything from I've got the gifts, I've got the emojis, I have developed a bit emoji that is. I'll say sometimes on the comical side, but there's a certain sector out there that I'm more likely to just go straight, play it straight with just text. And then there are others where I'll get a little creative, and there are some where I'll get creative in maybe a sophomoric type way, let's say.
See, I'm a big office fan. And so like my gift library is all office gifts. And so like, I'm like picturing for those fans of The Office, like the Stanley Hudson slow nod to you accepting a trade. I mean, is this what we're talking about? I mean, would you actually incorporate it along those lines?
Oh yeah, there. And that particular GIF of which you speak is in my bag of tricks. I've got a variety of them stemming from, it could be from The Office. It's Chris Farley. There's a number of Jim Carreys in my standard bag. There are some that depending on how things go, I think I have a GIF of Stephen Ray in the Crying Game in the shower. So there are number that you send out, and you just try to pick the most appropriate one. I've come up with anything that you see on the standard emoji board, from the happy face to the steaming pile of poo, and any one of them are in play.
Well, we'll get to some fan questions here, Jerry. And a reminder, as always, that listeners, you can email us very simply at thewheelhouse@mariners.com. Colin is the landlord of this email account. So if your question does not get chosen, you can tweet Colin. But Brian Kessler from Lake Stevens, a fine teacher at Marysville Pilchuck High School, and research indicates that they are the Tomahawks. So go Tomahawks. Brian asks this question for you, Jerry. That you are obviously well known as a numbers guy, very Statcast oriented, Sabre oriented, but What kind of stock or weight do you put on the idea of intangibles, Jerry, as a factor of success for an individual player or the team as a whole?
Huge. And I would say that while I am very statistically bent, and we do tend to rely on analytics to assist in our decision-making process, we try to be as balanced as we can, you know, looking at both the analysis and the scouting feedback on a player. I did spend about a decade in scouting, so I'd be lying if I told you that I didn't count on that heavily. But in terms of intangibles, I think intangibles, I don't want to say they supersede what goes on, but many of the trades that you will see us make are largely built on what we think the player's character, makeup, the intangibles are about. So you may see us send a player out the door that you're a little surprised that we moved, and you may see us bring in a player and invest more than you would logically think we should in a player. And that is almost always has to do with the intangibles or the makeup of the player. It's an important element to us. We're not scientists, but we're constantly trying to figure out how the 25 players fit together in a major league clubhouse. And you have to remember, when you're team building, we can plug in 20 homers, we can build in a 350 on base, we can plug in a 350 FIP, but at the end of the day, these guys are locked in a clubhouse together for about 200 days, and we have to find the right mix of personalities, of people, of work habits, and of desire. And you know, for me, when you find those players who take that kind of complete ownership of what they do and have that self-drive that they pass on to other players, and they have the ability to calmly pull their teammates aside and talk to them maturely, they're worth their weight in gold. You can't replicate those pieces, and those guys tend to stay around for a long time. And frankly, one of those guys, those intangible type players we just picked up this offseason in a utility role, is Andrew Romine, who's got a great feel for how the game works. Grew up in the game, understands his role, and his intangibles really allow him to contribute, despite the fact that on paper it's not going to look like an overwhelming result.
Yeah, you know, I'll share this with you too, to go full circle back to Taylor Motter. When Taylor was asked on the Caravan, just kind of an outlook of the team and going forward, and a pretty generic overarching question, you know, Taylor right away piped up by just almost gushing about the camaraderie on the team, and how that struck him even in spring training last year, and it carried through the entire season. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with some off the field intangibles, kind of what you're talking about. But I'd have to think, a man in your position, Jerry, as you are, I mean, I think a lot of people probably think this is just a higher stakes game of fantasy baseball. But I mean, these are real people with real personality, real baggage, whether that's good or bad. And so for you to put together 25 guys, or as we know, over the course of a full season, far more than just 25 guys, to have them all gel for that period of time, that's no easy feat.
It really isn't. And sometimes it's almost like mad science, where you try something, you realize that a guy who fit in another clubhouse environment doesn't quite fit in yours, and the like. And I know I learned great lessons about that during my time with the Red Sox, and it's probably not as prevalent outside of Boston and in New York, but those teams are so dialed into how a player is going to react in their market, because the market is so unique, and you learn lessons about team building, about putting the right pieces together, and frankly, having had the chance to play for a dozen years and watching the way clubhouses work, you know, it's you don't mind having guys that are edgy, but it's very difficult to have guys that are combative with one another. Mm-hmm. That creates problem.
I'm curious for you to expand on that briefly, because I almost forgot that you were with the Red Sox for, in the grand scheme of things, a very brief period of time before coming to Seattle. But obviously, in that brief stint with Dave Dombrowski and with the Red Sox, you learned a pretty vital lesson, or at least honed it a little bit more.
No, I was actually with the Red Sox as a scout in 2000, late 02 through the World Series in 04. So I was actually there for the beginning of the Theo Epstein journey to the Hall of Fame. You know, I was working in the pro scouting department at the time, and you know, it was then so many strong personalities, Johnny Damon, Derek Lowe, Jason Varitek, Curt Schilling. It was such a unique group of players that we were dealing with. And I know just like the Yankees, the Red Sox were super cognizant of the understanding how each of those players would adapt to the markets. And, you know, thankfully for us, that group really gelled together with a lot of unique personalities, David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, Nomar. And the Yankees for decades have been wired the same way. And now so many teams spend a lot of time trying to identify those emotional, psychological, even personality traits with the players they're acquiring. Because once you put them in a room together, you have to know that that effectively all of the different elements that you're trying to put in the sauce will make a sauce that tastes good. Otherwise, you just have a mess.
That's interesting, and a good history lesson too. Our final question today comes from Richard Moore, who wants to talk about the thing that controls the game these days, that is the bullpen. And kind of twofold here, Jerry, how much say do you have in bullpen usage, or is that something that is 100% Scott's? And to what extent is there a plan to leverage pitchers in different situations instead of just locking them down to, hey, you're the seventh inning guy, you're the eighth inning guy, you're the closer, that type of thing?
Actually, we interact on this as much, and when I say we, myself, Scott, Mel Stottlemyre, our front office, our analytical department, our advanced scouting group, we will coordinate on this element maybe more than anything we do. And, you know, once the game starts, now it's Scott's call. And we talk about the different personnel, how they best line up. We do maybe of the things you just mentioned, the one thing that we do really subscribe to is the leverage index. Try to make sure going into each game that we have a true feeling for when the let's call it the temperature is rising in the game. It's not always the eighth inning when you're up by three. Sometimes it's in the sixth inning of a tie game, depending on the circumstance, where you're going to see the highest leverage in that game. And as a result, what Scott does and has done, and I'll even stop for a moment and throw another blurb in here. We've actually hired two more pitching coaches for our major league staff, Jim Brower and Brian DeLunas. And Brower in particular will be in the dugout and play a very heavy role in this in terms of in-game pitching change and who is the best option in that moment. But back to how we do it, Scott will determine which pockets in the opponent's lineup best suit our pitchers, be it Nick Vincent or Mark Zepchinski or David Phelps. And, you know, the one guy who generally has an inning that he locks down is Edwin Diaz. But as you'll see or have seen, we're not opposed to bringing Eddie in the eighth inning if we have to, if the leverage calls for it. But we'll use pockets to determine when you're going to use Zepchinski, when you're going to use Vincent, and how to piece them together. And when all the weapons are healthy, when Nicasio and Phelps and Vincent and Zepchinski and Pazos and Diaz, et cetera, are all healthy, now you have the ability to play the chess match. Unfortunately, once you get into the middle of summer, sometimes all those pieces aren't ready to go and you have to ad lib as best you can. But we use leverage index and everything we do to try to determine matchups at the right time in the game and then pick the appropriate leverage. So each pitcher will be designated as regard to this is his pocket in high leverage, this is his pocket in medium leverage, and this is our guy who, if we have to go too early in the game, for his first out, so that each player knows what the expectation is that day. And it may result in a guy popping around and pitching in a variety of different innings. As you probably saw most notably, you know, last summer during that brief period when we had both Nick Vincent and David Phelps performing at the top of their games, sometimes Phelps would throw the eighth inning and sometimes Vincent would throw the sixth inning, or vice versa with the seventh and the eighth, because the pocket better suited the matchup with that pitcher.
Now, this is fascinating. When you talk about leverage index, I mean, is this another word for kind of Scott's gut and what's going on in the game? Or is there, I'm envisioning like an iPad with almost like a stock market tick as the game goes up and it goes down and it gets deeper into the game. I mean, or is it somewhere in between those two things?
It's the latter of those two things. It's and you can actually pull it up in the public forum on a variety of different sites. You can one that I know for certain, you can go to FanGraphs and pull up a leverage index and print it out, and it looks quite normal and it's very accurate. So we'll use a very similar index, call it a matrix. We used it in Arizona when I was there as well, and around the league. There's, I would say, better than 3 and 4 teams reference the leverage index and how they make their moves. And, it's funny you mentioned Scott's gut, or really anybody's gut. I worked with a good baseball man for a long time, and the one thing that he used to say, and I subscribe to, is there's really no such thing as gut. The guy with a good gut feel is the guy who's got more information than the other guy. It's just a matter of how you qualify and how you sort through your information. Some people need to look at a sheet. Some people just know how.
So the leverage index for the come from behind win in San Diego a number of years ago, around the sixth inning or so, probably didn't look so good. Or would that be more a win probability, I suppose, at that point?
Yeah, and we also have a win probability sheet provided by your friend and mine, Jack Mossman. But in regard to that game in San Diego, I think the starting pitcher that night for us was Wade Miley. He may have said it best when he said, he spotted them 10 runs. If he had only known that all he had to do was pitch 5 and hang on for a win. But I think the idea for us was the. In using our bullpen, we wanted to make sure that going into each game, we had a plan from manager through staff. We had a plan for how each pitcher was going to be used. And then obviously, like in most situations, if chaos occurs and you're forced into doing unusual things, you just do the best you can to put the pieces together. And, that night in San Diego was bizarre. No one would have expected that. Frankly, it was back-to-back bizarre nights with Paxton and Miley throwing those two games in San Diego. But they are not really representative of how we would best view a leverage index sheet, but more win probability. And frankly, if we were listening to the win probability sheet and told our players that the win probability was something less than zero, we wouldn't have come back and won. So we're back to question one from Brian. The intangibles or the qualities of the character sometimes supersede what you can do in analysis.
Yeah, those are good questions, both Brian and Richard. Well, hey, Jerry, man, this has been a lot of fun, as always, our 8th episode in the books. And remember, single game tickets are on sale now. Just simply go to Mariners.com or any Mariners team store. And we certainly cannot wait to see you Safeco Field opening day against the Tribe on March 29th. Well, Jerry, happy weekend to you, man. I hope the rain lets up a little bit in Seattle if it's still coming down. And I look forward to doing this again next week.
As do I. Please find some way to enjoy yourself in New York as I hop on a plane tomorrow to balmy Clinton, Iowa for a hot stove league dinner. Yeah. I'll be thinking of you, though, brother. I will be thinking of you.
Quickly, can you? I have not been to Clinton, but I have heard many people give me scouting reports on the smell in certain places of Clinton. Can you briefly elaborate?
Yeah, Clinton's, it's an awesome little town, like so many small Iowa towns are. It has the distinction of being the home to a dog food factory, so therefore there is a certain scent that you're going to get as soon as you enter the town. But it's been a great affiliate for us, and Clinton, dating back to the early 2000s, going in and out of there as a scout, any one of those Quad City zones, whether it's there, Quad City, it's Burlington, Iowa, there are a number of little Iowa cities that are just great for wholesome kind of grassroots baseball, and Clinton's one of them.
Well, we'll speak. Speaking of win probability, the Clinton Lumber Kings had like the greatest comeback of all time not all that long ago when they came back after trailing by 16 runs. I know Kyle's brother was a part of that, among other guys, obviously, as well. But so it goes to show, yeah, they were down. I just looked it up quickly. 20-17. They were down 17-1 after 5 innings, and they were able to come back and win that one. So you never know what's going to happen. That one was played in Burlington, Iowa. So good stuff there by the Lumber Kings.
That's just how we drew it up, Aaron. Just how we drew it up.
Well, Jerry, safe travels to you, man. We'll be talking to you next week.
Okay, you too.